The following presentation is brought to you by Rita, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity, a nonprofit public benefit corporation dedicated to disseminating the work and essential message of Dane Rudyard. All material is copyrighted by Layla Rudyard Hill. If you'd like to learn more about Rita or make a donation towards supporting the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com. We hope you enjoy the following presentation of the Sabian Symbols in Theory and Practice, Part 1, by Dane Rudyard. The recording is 45 minutes long.
Then I'm going to talk to you today about the Sabian symbols, about the way they can be used as oracles, like the I Ching is also used in China or even here now, and why those oracles are significant, what they refer to, and we want also to discuss the interpretation which Carl Jung has given to such practices and his approach to psychology and unconscious and all those matters. It's a big subject. But anyway, I think I have an approach which is a little different from that which is prevalent today. And I think it would be a good basis for discussion. And then this afternoon, Leila will go more concretely into the meaning of the symbols and their application to astrological charts, which I won't do today. Now, the first thing is perhaps to understand what is meant by a symbol. That sounds very simple, but it is not simple because most people have no idea what it really means. Now, if you study psychology or certain kind of psychology or logic in college, there are all sorts of new system, science, semiotics, semantics, and all sorts of things which deal with symbols and also signs. Now, the first thing to realize is there is a great basic difference between a symbol and a sign, though those things, those two words have been unfortunately used interchangeably where they shouldn't be used interchangeably. Now, it's simple enough. A sign is simply a way, a conventional way, of communicating to other people that certain condition or circumstance or certain requirements exist at a certain time, at a certain place. Now, if you are traveling a road, in a car, you have certain sign which tell you how far a city is, if you are entering a city, the speed that you are supposed to travel in, and all that. Those are all signs, you see. Now, signs are strictly factual. They are a conventional and socially understandable way of presenting facts. Now, when you are dealing with mathematics and algebra, the N, the X, the H, or whatever letters that you use, or even things like plus, minus, square roots, and all those things, are all signs, you see. Now, however, there are certain cases where a sign can become a symbol. Now, take, for instance, the famous equation of Einstein, E equal mc2, energy equals the mass multiplied by the square of the speed of light. Now, this is a sign, except that if you have been in Hiroshima, or if you are very upset by the possibility of nuclear war and all that, that you have an emotional reaction to what has come out of that sign. when you see the sign, it may become suddenly, it may evoke in your mind and in your consciousness all what has happened as a result of having found that sign, you see. So it becomes a symbol. It becomes something which radiates a definite meaning, which has an emotional content, which convey to people who know its meaning the power of the atom bomb or of any other things connected with it, you see. Now, a symbol, therefore, is a means to transfer certain meanings which have experientiable contents, which you have experienced or which you can experience, and so that they are not merely conventional indications, but they are based on actual facts which have happened and which has caused a very profound reaction on you personally or on the people at large which you are connected with, you see. Now, there is a great deal of difference between a fact and a symbol. I mean, a fact is something which is precisely defined. A fact is precisely what it is and nothing else. But a symbol is more than what it is, you see. Because it describes not only a precise particular situation, but it points to a complex group of meanings and feelings, of emotion, of values, and all that kind of things. In other words, symbols integrate the separate experiences and aspirations of a vast number of people. They take a particular event or a series of events out of the realm of a unique situation for fortuitous chance occurrence and so on. And it related to a realm of what we call in philosophy universals, vast complex categories of events and ideas and so on, which have a very definite meaning, at least in terms of a particular culture. Now, every culture is based on a number of great symbols, images, which are the foundation on which the values and concepts and imperatives of that culture are based, you see. Now, for instance, the crucifixion, the cross, or the sitting Buddha, the stone of the Kaaba in the Mecca, all those great symbols of religion which are at the foundation of any particular religion and culture, all those things are symbols. They are, Spengler used to call them Urbild, prime symbols, basic foundation on which a whole culture is based. Now, all words are symbols because they establish a common basis for the experiences of millions of human beings, you see. And they establish the possibility for those human beings to communicate with them when they face a basic social need, or particularly in early case when they warn of danger. If the tribesman suddenly saw a tiger in the forest and was able to yell tigers, you know, and therefore to convey to the other tribesmen that there was danger there, they could all come with spears and perhaps control the tiger. But he alone, of course, wouldn't have been able to do it, probably. So that the word symbol, the image created by that, referred to a whole series of meaning, all series of events which are in the memory of that particular group or tribe, and therefore which they are able to deal with together, you see, because there has been a way to express the danger or the meaning of that particular event. If you go into a Catholic home in France or Italy or Spain, here you find a crucifix with a crucified Christ on it, on practically every bedroom, over the bed. Well, this is a symbol of communication, that they all believe in a certain things, and the idea of the crucifixion and all what is implied in the idea of suffering and the breaking down of the ego and the possibility of resurrection, if you want to go into a more psychological and mystical frame of reference. All that possibility is that, and it is there at the head of the person. I mean, that is the great ideal of that particular culture. And the same is true if you have a tanka of a Buddhist or any kind of image, which will also symbolize the essential nature of the particular culture, or the great values to which the person responds, and all the group of persons respond, you see. Now, in a certain sense, I'm not going to discuss the matter, but astrology is also a language. It is a set of symbols, because it all deals with the idea that the sky is an expression, a symbol, the motion of the points and dots of light, which are regular, which are periodical, which are trustable. It is all an expression of the fact, essentially, that we live in a universe of order. We can trust that universe. We can trust the fact that there is order. Therefore, we can think in terms of laws, and we know that if we do certain thing, certain causes are set in motion, and it will produce certain very definite results. Now, in a way, all astrology is a symbol of the fact that it is a universe, a world of order, a universe of order. And therefore, we can depend on it to discover certain principle on which our whole life can be based, you see. So that, in a way, symbols are instrumentalities provided by any culture, our culture, through the use of which we can come to terms with and understand the complexity of any life situation which will arise. And again, that is the essential meaning of astrology. You are facing a very difficult situation, and you want to try to understand what it means in your life and in itself. And you can then establish a chart which will tell you, well, those are the elements which are involved in that situation, and it will resolve itself in a certain way, especially if you do orary charts and so on, you see, which give you then a symbol of how to deal with a particular situation. Now, when you are dealing with things like the I Ching or the Sabian symbols for the 360 degrees of the zodiac, you are dealing with a cycle of symbols. It's a closed series of symbols. It has a beginning, it has an end, and it has certain very definite pattern, arrangement between the middle, the end, the beginning, and various kind of structures which are involved in cyclic processes. Now, all existence is a process. That is to say, you are born, you will mature, and you eventually will die. Anything has a beginning and a middle and an end. Everything, every phase of existence is part of a process, which, if you understand its structure, you are able to also understand the meaning of that particular phase and that particular event. See, all what we are dealing there with the process of understanding what is, understanding what befalls to us, what we are dealing with, what we have to face, and problems, if you want to put it in a broad sense of the term, that we have to solve. And of course, one of the problems is who am I and why am I here, which is one of the basic problems, of course, of astrology. Now, the thing that you have to understand, which is very difficult to understand for some people, and you can think about it, and if you want to ask me more detail about it, you could stop me there, because it's a very important point, is that according to the idea of either the I Ching in China or the Sabian symbol, there are only a certain number of basic qualities of response to existence, of response to the problem of existence. That is to say, when you are faced with a problem, a basic situation, there are only a certain number of ways in which you can face it significantly and understand its basic meaning. What, therefore, you are dealing with is what you can call, though the term is very confusing, archetypal solutions, you see. Archetypes means simply that behind any actual experience, any actual event that you are facing, there are certain fundamental way of facing it, which either will push you or give you the opportunity to face it in a most significant and the most constructive manner. Now, the whole idea is that if you have any problem, if you have any situation which it is difficult for you to understand and to deal with, therefore, you can go back to a series of archetypal solutions, you see. And the problem there is to find which of those archetypal solutions is the right one. Now, the reason why it is difficult to understand is because, you see, we have been so completely hypnotized or brainwashed by a strictly individualistic and egocentric kind of philosophy of life or attitude to life, which tells us that we are unique, extraordinary people, and we are free, and we can do anything you please, we can do any choice that we want. And if you tell to somebody, but look, there are only 360 or 64 ways of facing those problems, they say, what are you talking about? You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't believe that there are only a relatively small number of basic solutions to all the problems of existence, then you better never deal with either the I Ching or the Sabian symbols, because that's what you get when dealing with them. Now, as I repeat, unless you are willing to take that attitude, then it makes no sense whatsoever to deal with the symbols, especially in terms of oracles, you see. Because if you throw the coin of the I Ching and you don't think that there are only 64 basic ways, well, it's still more than 64 because you have permutation and changing line and all that. I don't remember exactly how many totally it may mean, but it would be not much more than 200 or 300 or whatever it is. Anyway, and then of course it's no use to throw them out, you know, because I mean it's just like if you want to have your fortune told in through cookies in Chinese restaurants, and And if you believe in them, you have to have an idea that there probably are no more than 300 or probably less of those little band of paper. And if you believe in them, then you have to believe that it is a limited possibility of facing your life at any particular moment, you see. So that is really the essential things. Now you can, you see, that doesn't mean, now you have to be very careful about it. That doesn't mean that there are only 360 or 64 type of event that will follow a decision. There may be millions, billions of them. That is not the point. The symbol doesn't deal with the actual event. It deals with the archetypal meaning of those situations. In other words, you can divorce and have a dozen of more marriages, but the idea is, in many cases, that there is a certain image of the other partner that you will project to into any kind of marriage that you will make. I mean, that's not always the case, but I mean, quite often it does happen, you see. So that, in other words, the events will differ, but the archetype of the solution of the problem of what kind of partner must I have for the best possible way may remain the same thing, even though the partner themselves as individual change completely, you see, or seem to change completely. But actually what you see in them or want of them is the same thing, or the same basic thing, you see. But you see, the difficulty is that we are so concerned with our freedom, with our uniqueness, our individuality, that the idea that there are some overarching pattern of existence or possibilities of existence and development, and that possibility is very difficult for us to really understand. We can intellectually, you can say yes, 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 but to feel it and all that is very difficult, because it's just the opposite of what we are trained to think about. Now let me say a few things about the Sabian symbols. The Sabian symbols, there are many symbols of so-called degrees of the zodiac, which have been presented in the last decades, and there were some also in the medieval time. But those Sabian symbols, to me, are the most remarkable one for various reasons. First, because of their inner structure, and particularly of the way they were produced. Now, I don't know who has read my book, An Astrological Mandala, where I tell about all the way they were produced and all that. Well, not too many people, well, some people, but no. Anyway, I find, unfortunately, that many people who have my book don't read the first part or the last part and only look at the symbols of their planets, which is, of course, an absolutely wrong way of doing. Because unless you understand what it's all about and how to use it, to just simply say, oh, that is a symbol for Libra 19, my son is there, let's see what the symbol is for my son. If you don't understand what symbols are or the Sabian symbol, it really makes no sense except confusing you. Now, the Sabian symbol were produced in, I think, 1926 in San Diego, California, by two persons. One was Mark Edmund-Jones, the well-known astrologer and philosopher, because he's more a philosopher really than an astrologer, just in a way that I am. And occultists. He has a group, the Sabian Assembly, which has been functioning for 60 years or so. And the other person was Elsie Wheeler, who was a clairvoyant who was crippled, had to carry in a wheelchair, arthritis, and very bad arthritis, and so on. I met her, and I knew, of course, Mark Jones very well. And what happened was that she was eager to use her remarkable capacity of seeing images. Clairvoyant, when you would come to her, she immediately would see images to your problem. You ask her something, she would, like the real clairvoyant thing, you see an image which become a symbol, you see, of the particular situation which you want to solve or understand. So Marjon knew her, and he was very much interested in trying to get a series of symbols for the sign of the zodiac. He had done that before with another clairvoyant, with the ordinary card, playing cards. But this woman, Elsie Wheeler, was particularly remarkable and very devoted and very lovely person. So they went to, that was 1926, it was not so much car at that time. He took her from San Diego into his car, and they went to the Central Park in San Diego, which at that time was not very frequented. San Diego was a very small city at the time. And they parked the car in a big park. They parked the car in a small alley or something like that, and then proceeded to get to work. Now, what Marjon did was to have small cards, you know, a small filing card like that, 360 of them, and in the right corner, very small, almost hardly legible, was in sign areas 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, Paris 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So he had those 360 cards which he didn't look at. He constantly kept shuffling them, you know, so that he wouldn't take in any order whatsoever. He would take one card out, things with close eye, and not just show the card, not even, you couldn't possibly see the symbol, I think, to Elsie Wheeler, and said, "What do you see?" And she immediately would see a scene, and he would quickly, in a kind of, well, it's not shorthand, it was actually written, I've seen the card, in a few words, say, condense what she saw, and then pass the new card. Now, the extraordinary thing is that they did the 360 degree in one afternoon, 90 degree one time, then they stopped for a few minutes, drove around the park, came back to the same situation, 90 again, had lunch for a couple, an hour or so, some far away, I mean not far away, but I mean in a place where nobody could see them or they wouldn't be seeing anybody they knew. Came back, did 90, stopped a little, did 90. I calculated that it probably means that it took about 1 minute and a half for each symbol. Now, this, as far as I know, is an absolutely unparalleled feat. You know, I mean, whatever. Now, the thing which makes it even more extraordinary is that the thing which was as random as can be, short of having a computer or mixing up and anything like that, you know. The point is that when you study those things, you will see that they are very definite structure. The opposites are related to another. The four, you can make a fourfold relationship. You can make a relationship of a sequence of 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Leila will speak about that this afternoon. There are a number of things. We can see a few of them if we have time. And so that you have something which is absolutely structured in a most logical way. Sometimes it is not too easy to realize the structure because of the character of the symbols and so on. But anybody who is very experienced with meaning and symbols and all that can see that there is a definite relationship. Now, how such a kind of relationship could come out of a completely random kind of performance at that particular speed is absolutely incredible. You know. Well, of course, the only almost possibility of explanation is that there were some super physical, superhuman forces that were at work in it, and of course, Marchand guardedly mentioned that. He mentioned it in writing, or probably a little more about it, but not very much anyway. He speak of touching the unconscious or the collective memory of some Babylonian brotherhood and all that, which is a nice way of not saying too much. You know. But it seems evident that there were some consciousness or intelligence or what you want to call it. And I could tell you more about it perhaps, but we'll come to that a little bit later, but we won't have time to go into that. So anyway, so that it is, that was not only to some extent Marjone and Elsie Wheeler, but there was an X there, which obviously channeled whatever the set of meaning was there. But you see, the thing that you have to realize, that whatever was channeled in terms of archetype meaning was expressed through the mind of Elsie Wheeler. Marjone may have made the link for to bring the higher mind down into a more concrete focus and focusing it in on the mind of Elsie Wheeler. But she was a very plain woman. She was in the 40s, I think, or something like that at the time. Well, yeah, I guess 40 or maybe late 40. You are dealing with a mind of an average sensitive, but a very average Western Californian woman in the year 1926. I never forget that. Just that you must never forget that whoever was Prince Wu or Shen or whatever it was, who supposedly formulated the first teaching things, was a man operating in the China of 1000 or more BC. So that the actual image that you have are to be seen or understood at two levels. The obvious level is the kind of, in the case of the Sabian symbol, of a very typical American Western mind, which deal with something like girls in uniforms or, I don't know if there is baseball things, oil drilling and this kind of things, which are part of the mentality of an average South Californian woman of that period. But the point is that behind that, if the thing is significant, then there are a set of archetypal meaning. Now, in the I Ching, of course, those archetypal meaning are expressed in a highly abstract form in terms of the permutation of two principles, yin and yang, related in six levels, in all the possibility of relationship of those six levels of two principles. The thing is not quite as clear in the case of the 360 degree of the zodiac. Marjone, however, attempted to do that, which I don't think was too convincing. By dividing it, you will see, especially if you have his books and the Sabian symbol, about a little formula at the end of every symbol, which say whether they are positive, negative, whether they are fixed, mutable, whether this, so that every degree has a certain character in terms of the place that it occupies within the whole circle of the zodiac, you see. So you can think of it in a highly abstract form, But that won't help you very much, I'm afraid, especially in the case of the Sabian symbol. And so the main thing to do is to try to understand the basic meaning, the fundamental meaning, which is partly revealed and mostly hidden within the formulation, a formulation which is completely conditioned, not completely, but I mean conditioned by the mentality of L.C. Wheeler at that time. So the symbol, in practically all cases, have not to be taken literally. You have to extract from it the essential meaning of the symbol. And the way to do so is to consider every possible element that are part of the dramatized scene or allegory or picture and so on, which you have in the symbol, you see. Now, just take the first degree of Aries. A woman emerges out of the ocean. A seal is wrapped around her. Well, you can just say, we are dealing there, of course, with the first thing, and so we are dealing with the emergence of an individual out of the collective, and so on. That's fine. But you see, yeah, then you forget about the seal. The seal is very important, you know. It's not just merely somebody emerging out of the ocean in a rowboat or in a scaphander or something like that, you know. But what is, first it's a woman. Well, I mean, I don't want to go into that. Except that from a traditional symbolical point of view, the woman is more the passive and receptive polarity of life. So that, in other words, you don't start a cycle like one of those cycle of symbol, I don't remember which one that, which one it is. Anyway, it's one of those that is published in that little English book on symbol of the degrees. A man in full armor ready to go and, you know, and powerful. And you don't start a cycle ready to go powerful and so on. A baby is not powerful when he is born. You see, nothing starts in a powerful way. There may be power, great power behind it. But when actually you are dealing with the problem of a situation, when you start a cycle, you are never absolutely sure and ready to go, boom, I'm going to show them. You see, that's one of the reasons why if you're born in a new moon, there is very often a certain kind of confusion, because the experience there is of being in the pure potentiality of existence is so strong that you are still very open and all that, you know, but not aggressive like that, you know. That's one thing. The second thing is that what's the seal doing there? Well, the seal is a very interesting thing. It's a mammal, you see. And it is a creature which apparently was born and managed to emerge out of the sea and operate in the land and return to the sea. And you know, some of those mammals, sea mammals, like seals, have to go on the land to procreate and all that, and then they return to the sea. So that their essential nature, their life energy, really focused on the sea, but for some reason they don't want to go, to stay there. You know, it's complicated. It's much harder to be back in the sea where you can swim happily and so on. You know, the idea of returning to the womb in a psychiatric case and so on. So that it shows that the beginning is very open, very receptive to any potentiality. That doesn't mean it's a lower level. No, that's not the point. You are open to all potentiality. And at the same time, you are surrounded with the ghost of the past. And the capacity, the urge to return to the comfortable womb of the sea, it's very great. It's wrapped all around you, you see. So you see, if you want to analyze that degree, you have to take not only the just obvious thing, oh, well, somebody's born out of the sea, like Venus out of the sea. No, you have to see every detail of the picture. And that applies to every symbol and so on. Now, let's go to try to deal a little with the situation which is presented by Jung's interpretation, because it was announced and that I should, and perhaps some people are very interested in that. It is a very interesting way to deal with the problem, to see how Jung dealt with it in relation to the I Ching, not the Sabian symbol, which he probably didn't know anything about it, though he may have read it in my book, Astrology of Personality. But anyway, never mention it. Jung approach, of course, you find it very, as rather clearly marked in that book, The Secret of the Golden Flower, and in the last part of it, where he discussed the use of symbols and what he calls synchronicity. That is the first time that, to my mind, to my knowledge, he used the term, which I think is one of those terms which are very convenient, because it doesn't mean anything, and therefore you can make it mean anything you want it to mean. But you have to understand Jung's position. Now let me first read a few things from him, which I think is quite significant. It's some, I don't know, that's the old edition I have. There is a paperback, I don't know if it is the same edition or same page number or not, but it's called page 128. It's in the last part after he has, what is it called? Oh no, it's the speech that he gave after the death of Wilhelm. And there is a chapter called The Fulfillment, page 128. It says, "It is my firm intention to bring into the daylight of psychological understanding, daylight, things which have a metaphysical sound, and to do my best to prevent the public from believing in obscure power words." Now, the term obscure power word is quite remarkable when later on he deals with synchronicity, which certainly is obscure. To understand metaphysically is impossible. It can only be done psychologically. I therefore strip things of their metaphysical wrappings in order to make them objects of psychology. In this way, I can at least get something comprehensible out of them and can avail myself of it. If there should still lurk something metaphysical that cannot be formulated, it should then have the best opportunity of showing itself. And he say, to be specific in this matter, I can say that my admiration for the great Eastern philosopher is as great, as indubitable as my attitude toward their metaphysics is irreverent. I suspect them of being symbolical psychologists to whom no greater wrong could be done than to be taken literally. If it were really metaphysic that they mean, it would be useless to try to understand them. But if it is psychology, we can not only understand them, but we can profit greatly by them. For then the so-called metaphysical comes within the range of experience. If I accept the fact that a God is absolute and beyond all human experience, he leaves me cold. I do not affect him, nor does he affect me. But if I know, on the other hand, that God is a mighty activity in my soul, at once I must concern myself with him. He can then become even unpleasantly important, and in practical ways too, which sounds horribly banal, like everything appearing in the sphere of reality. Well, the point, he goes on in many places further, in which he describes a great deal of the attitude of Oriental philosophy, and they warn the people very strongly as to go in for metaphysics and yoga practice and all those things like that, which would be the betrayal of their Western approach and dangers, even though if you look at it from the point of view of psychology, then there is a lot that the East can bring to us. He said, of what use to us is the wisdom of the Upanishads or the insight of the Chinese yoga if we desert the foundations of our culture as though they were outlived errors and like homeless pirates settled with thievish intent on foreign shores. Our way begins in European reality and not in yoga practices, which would only serve to lead us astray as to our own reality. Now, that is part of his whole approach.
This is the end of the Sabian Symbols in Theory and Practice, Part 1, by Dane Rudyard. The preceding audio is copyrighted by Layla Rudyard Hill and was brought to you by Rita, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity. Learn more about Rita or contribute to the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard at www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com.